Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Wall Street and the world of finance is dominated by men. Men on the trading floor, men in the boardrooms, women pretty scarce, even now. Could that imbalance have helped bring about the Wall Street-driven collapse of our economy? While Washington ponders new regulation, we're going to the hormones today, to the endocrine system of American finance. This hour on point, men, women, testosterone, risk, and the endocrine system of Wall Street. You can join the conversation. What if the Boys Club on Wall Street was a boys and girls club? Would it change American finance? Can you picture it? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me first today from New York is Sheila Kolhatkar. She's a contributing editor at New York Magazine, where she covers Wall Street and more. Her big news story is, what if women ran Wall Street? Sheila, welcome to On Point. Thanks for being here.
Hi, Tom. Nice to be here.
So we're playing with counterfactuals today because they do not run Wall Street. They're not even close, right?
You mean the women?
Yes, I mean the women.
No, they certainly do not. I became interested in this because I used to be one of them. I worked for several years as a hedge fund analyst on Wall Street, and one of the things I really noticed during that time was that I was often the only woman in the room. I would go to analyst meetings and social events and trading floors occasionally, and there were so few women, and it really seemed very remarkable to me. And fast forward a few years later, I watched the financial crisis unfold. Various banks were collapsing. Other ones needed to be rescued. And I started to think about the question of why this had happened. And it just seemed that there were very few women involved at top levels at any of these companies. And of course, months later, we see women like Sheila Bair at the FDIC and Elizabeth Warren, who's monitoring the TARP program for the Congressional Oversight Panel. And there were even some women on Wall Street like Meredith Whitney, who was a bank analyst who was sort of celebrated for predicting that Citigroup was going to run into serious trouble before almost anyone else. And I started to wonder whether there was a gender component to this, because it just seemed that some of these women were not part of the groupthink that was dominating Wall Street. And they had been brought in to clean up some of the mess, and it was sort of fascinating to me. And once I started asking questions about, you know, sort of gender, it led immediately to the issue of biological differences and the question of hormone in particular and how that affects risk-taking.
We're going to get a lot of perspectives on this hour. John Coates in the UK has done some research. We'll hear from him. Nancy Kane at Harvard Business School is with us. We'll hear from her in a minute on the pipeline of who's coming into finance. I mean, you've got a great headline here, What If Women Ran Wall Street? But I have to say, my first response was rolling eyes, not because I'm against it, not at all, but it just seems such a male environment. That seems so counterfactual. I mean, could that ever happen? How far are we from that now? Just how male is it now, Sheila?
It is very male. I don't know exact numbers because many of these firms conceal that information. We don't really know what the precise gender breakdown is. But no, it is obviously very, very male.
Doesn't take a weatherman to know which way that wind is blowing. I mean, you just described the scene when people come to work. It's guys stampeding onto the floor.
Yeah. No, that's absolutely true. I visited the floor of the stock exchange several times. And the only other thing that really compares is a, you know, sort of a men's locker room after a rugby game. I mean, it's really not, it's not a place where you see many women. And of course, the chances that it would become a female-dominated world are very slim. However, I would add that a diversity of viewpoint has been shown to be very good for these big firms, for the bottom line in general. Many, many studies have been done showing that having more women making decisions at companies is very good for business. There have even been some studies done in Europe suggesting that, you know, companies with more women close to the top fared better through the financial crisis. And the London Business School just released one study suggesting that work groups that have more gender balance are more productive. So really, Wall Street needs to figure out and sort of take to heart this idea that diversity and sort of more more points of view at the table when decisions are being made would be a good thing. And it's going to be a long road getting there, definitely.
Diversity, maybe some cooler heads, and maybe not right off the cliff. You write about testosterone turning the men of Wall Street into a herd of overheated animals. And off they go. Sheila Kohatkar in New York, if you'd stand by for just a second, we've got one of those who's done some real research on this with us today from London. John Coates joins us. He's a senior research fellow in neuroscience and finance at the University of Cambridge, formerly ran a derivatives trading desk for Deutsche Bank in New York. John Coates, thanks very much for being here.
Hi, Tom.
You know this world. You've done the research. How do endocrine systems, hormones, testosterone come into play, John?
Well, much along the lines that you've already discussed, I began to suspect that there was a hormone at play during the dot-com bubble because, as you just said, I was running a trading desk on Wall Street, and I noticed that the traders on the floor, their behavior had changed from what it used to be. They would become delusional, euphoric, they had diminished need for sleep, racing thoughts. These are clinical symptoms of mania, and it wasn't that the job was selecting for this type of people because the traders I was observing this in weren't like that before the bubble and they weren't like that after the bubble popped. In fact, after the bubble had popped, they were more or less like people coming down off a narcotic. I wasn't really caught up in the dot-com bubble at the time. I was pretty objective about it. But in previous periods when I was experiencing above-average profits, I had felt a chemical high which was as powerful as anything I felt, as powerful as sexual desire or wall-banging anger. Mm. And so I was convinced that there was a chemical at play here. And it occurred to me in sort of a light bulb moment that in all the research that had gone into figuring out what causes bubbles and crashes from economics, psychology, game theory, neuroscience, nobody had ever looked medically at what was happening to traders when they were caught up in one of these events. And just by a pure accident, I was splitting my time during this period between the trading desk on Wall Street and a neuroscience lab at Rockefeller University, which has got some of the best scientists in the world studying the effect of steroids on the brain.
Okay.
And there I came across just an absolutely fantastic model from animal behavior called the winner effect. Now, in this model, when two male animals go into a competition, their testosterone levels rise, which is basically the role of testosterone because it increases the hemoglobin in your blood and your blood's capacity to carry oxygen. It increases your appetite for risk and it increases your confidence. So when these two male animals go into this competition, the winner of the competition comes out with even higher testosterone, but the loser comes out with lower testosterone. So the winner goes into the next round of competition with these already elevated testosterone levels, and that gives him an edge for all that he's got a physical and takes more risk. He's got an edge. He wins again, which is why this phenomenon is called the winner effect.
And up and up it goes. And so maybe that's what bubbles are. It's not about tulips or dot-coms or
In fact, more than that, they think this might be the physiological substrate to winning and losing streaks in sports as well. That it's not just that you get kind of psyched out when you're losing. You're actually, you know, your testosterone levels are plummeting. But the interesting thing about the model is what happens, the end game of this feedback loop, because these testosterone victory feedback loop can't go on forever. What happens when the testosterone reaches a certain level in your body after winning a couple of rounds is that your appetite for risk and your confidence segue into, morph into overconfidence and risky behavior. So the animals experiencing this upward cycle of testosterone and victory, after a while they go out in the open too much, they pick too many fights, they neglect parenting duties, and they patrol areas that are too large. And as a result, their rates of predation go up. And I thought, this is exactly what's going on Wall Street. It's the chemical, I think, that's driving, that I had felt, that's driving these traders. And moreover, the other great fact I noticed during the dot-com bubble is that women seemed relatively unaffected. So all the pieces sort of fell together. I thought this is the model that will explain what takes a bull market and transforms it into a bubble. Because the hormones don't cause the bull market. The technology did, for example, during the dot-com bubble era.
It gets people excited, but the endocrine system may run with it.
Yeah, I think what turns a bull market into a bubble and a bear market into a crash. And the fact that women were relatively unaffected by the dot-com bubble, for me, it was like, you know, the extra bit of data I needed to set up this hypothesis in a scientifically testable manner. And I went back to Cambridge.
We'll hear about that. But I want to ask you, Sheila, in New York, we've got a break coming up here. But what are you suggesting here? That a few more women would work as a circuit breaker here, kind of chill all the men out so that this upward cycle of testosterone doesn't lead them right off the cliff? Is that the idea?
I think the most important takeaway from all of this is that diversity of viewpoints is very, very important. And a big part of that is having more women, absolutely. And I think the problem from the bank's perspective with that is having a more balanced viewpoint would really change the model they have going right now, which is this boom and bust model, roller coaster of home runs followed by collapses. That model is not desirable. It is not working out for most of us. But the
guys in it have tended to like it, and they've made a pile of money with it.
They certainly have. And the thing is that now they have realized that they will enjoy a taxpayer backstop when things go downhill. So what's really going on right now, the battle over regulatory reform really is going to be very important, because this is going to determine the culture of Wall Street going forward, and it's a culture that needs to change.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking to Sarah about men, women, and Wall Street. Testosterone in the boom and bust, and whether there's a better way or not. Sheila Kahatkar is with us. She writes for New York Magazine, got us thinking here with her big article, headline, What If Women Ran Wall Street? John Coates is with us, former derivatives trader for Deutsche Bank in New York. He's now in London with us today, senior research fellow in neuroscience and finance at the University of Cambridge. And with me in the studio, and it's good to see her again, is Nancy Kane, professor of business administration at Harvard Business School, expert on entrepreneurial leadership and its history. Latest book is The Story of American Business. Nancy Kane, great to see you. Thanks for being here.
Pleasure to be here, Tom.
So what do you think? I mean, I started off skeptical. Nothing against women. Bring them on in. But it just seems like, you know, guys and guy stuff is what the street has always been. Could it be different? What do you think of the case that, you know, testosterone, what, upward cycles of cascade drive us off a cliff?
I think that the magnitude of the issue here at hand, which is really the stability and performance of the global capital markets, which mm-hmm. touch virtually every person and creature on this planet,
as we have learned to some pain.
Through some pain and suffering, right? Pushback learning mm-hmm. means we have to think very incisively about what are the forces here. Now, there are some good numbers here. John's talked about them. Sheila's talked about them. There are other numbers as well that predate the financial crisis about men overtrading. Now, whether that's a function of testosterone or whether it's a function of something else, men overtrade.
Meaning?
Meaning they trade much more in a common day, mm-hmm. on a typical day, and they trade and then trade a stock again.
So do a deal, do a trade.
And that's very mm-hmm. consistent with what John's talking about, mm-hmm. right? We think about this elevating cycle.
It feels good.
Feels good, right? Mm-hmm. Feels mm-hmm. good, and you're on it, and you're in control. And if you look at the numbers, UC Davis has a good study on this from the dot-com bubble. If you look at some of those numbers, men overtrade as much as 67%. Well, that would not necessarily be an issue if performance wasn't affected. But guess what? Diminishing marginal returns set in, whatever sets in, too much risk-taking, as Sheila's talking about. And in the end, single women on the trading floor actually outperform men in study after study. And in the closest link that the regressions point to is this link about overtrading. So if that's the case, if there really is a very important gender difference in how men and women handle currency and assets that now affect almost every institution and every individual on the planet, mm-hmm. then we have to talk about this and we have to think about it.
But there's some people will say amen. Others are going to be skeptical. Let me share with you and all of my guests. Here's Karen on Facebook, and she writes, While it's interesting to talk about the chemical makeup of traders who live and work in an incredibly intense environment, I think it's safe to say that blaming the financial crisis on testosterone is overreaching. If you're following that line of logic, we could also blame our wars in the Middle East, dictatorships, and ethnic cleansing on testosterone. And I hope, Karen writes, that seems absurd. John Coates, what do you say to our correspondent there?
Well, I think she's right. We're focusing on hormones not because we think they're the only thing at play. We're focusing on them because economics isn't, and we think they're important. But I certainly wouldn't say that testosterone was the only thing that caused the credit crisis. I mean, there were low interest rates, low interest rates, extremely easy terms to get mortgages. A number of things actually created the credit crisis. The testosterone, it was just sort of the spice.
But in a way, your logic does come back to it because you're suggesting men, once they get a taste of that catnip, it goes up and up. There's not a circuit breaker there. If there had been women, Nancy's kind of the implication here, they would have said, look, interest rates are kind of crazy low, let's settle down, let's not keep going.
Yep, that's true. Women have about 10% of the testosterone as males, so it's likely that they're more or less immune to this winter effect that we've been studying. But the other point I'd make is that when we first started publishing these papers in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, we made the suggestion that it's possible that bubbles are a male phenomenon. And if that's the case, then what you do need on the trading floor is an endocrine diversity, which is what we're talking about today. But we were only talking about women today. There's two ways of getting endocrine diversity. It's not only males and females, but it's also young and old. And trading floors are as intolerant of older people as they are of women. So it seems to me that you can get extreme forms of behavior whenever you isolate one section of the population, like all young men. And there may be times when you want that. Maybe in the times of war you want that. But when it comes to allocating society's capital, I think you want the entire village there. And I think that means you want young and old, men and females, men and women, because then you get the optimal endocrine diversity.
This is really interesting. I want to come to you with that proposal, Sheila. But still, Nancy Kane, I'm looking at our Facebook comment from Karen, and she says, look, if that were true for the markets, then couldn't you say the same thing about wars and dictatorship and ethnic cleansing? And pretty soon it's just a big critique of men and testosterone. Pretty soon it's just, bring back the matriarchy. Let's go back 10,000 years. Maybe that's what we're talking here, but...
Oh, I'm not sure. I'm not sure that's where we're going with this. I think we want to realize that the testosterone evidence, which is interesting and important, is a doorway into a larger set of issues about the importance, the pragmatic, performance results of a more diverse group in such an important around such an important table. Look, it's a big poker game, but it's a poker game that the world economy and life on this planet depend on. So who's sitting around that table? I'm talking about the fuel of global capitalism matters. Now, there is very good scientific research. John knows it well about diversity in decision making, right? McKinsey's done some, Pepperdine's done some. There's a really interesting guy at the University of Michigan named Simon Page who's done a 30-year study and formulated something called the diversity prediction theorem that says put different people around a table, a la what John just said, and guess what? They solve business problems better and faster than a single homogeneous group. So, again, who's around that table? Who are they talking to? And finally, what do we want our markets to look like? Do we want our markets to be driven by big high spikes, right, and then big lows?
But I think that's a very reasonable question. I mean, there's a kind of an organics question here. What is this really about? Is it about making money? Or is it maybe the pleasure of that high in the boom is so intense that the guys involved in it are sure, they're fine with it. Why do you think we call it a bull market?
Well, what if it's not about making money, Tom? What if for them it's about feeling good and collecting
points?
That's
what I mean. Maybe it's not a rational market. Maybe it's something entirely different. Let's go to Brian calling from Torrington, Connecticut. Brian, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Well, I think I'm okay. My testosterone's getting pumped up around this issue. Maybe my estrogen will kick in soon.
I got to say that I'm really not buying into this. The market, as everybody knows, is absolutely money-driven. Great. You know what? You're going to work. You're doing a good job. You're getting high from making those trades. That's awesome. But it's not going to matter if it's testosterone or estrogen. In the end, it's what's in your pocket that makes you happy. And that's why you work on the market.
But what if guys love the thrill of the chase almost as much as they love the ultimate success, and so they're willing to, you know, kick it up until it crashes, Brian?
I don't think so. I think that people, especially with a lot of the big houses, they're put into a place where, look, if you can drive, you know, the money point higher, you'll earn more. And that's what's driving people to do this. I mean, if you're a child and you can figure out the market, put that child in front of a PC and that child is going to make money. It's not going to matter if you're a man or a woman. And if so, then why don't we see more women in these houses making money? Are we saying that they're blocked out?
Yeah, no, it's a good question. Sheila, thank you, Brian. Sheila, I know we're going to let you go in a minute. I mean, maybe it's the system. Maybe it's compensation. Put anybody in that seat. You can make $100,000 or you can make $100 million, and they're going to, I guess, go for the $100 million, man or woman. What about it, Sheila?
Well, I have two things to say about that. First of all, how do you explain the fact that so many people at different levels throughout these banks and elsewhere made decisions that were obviously terrible business decisions?
Because they really made a lot of money along the way before it crashed.
There are people. Michael Lewis has a book out right now about one person who saw what seems really obvious, that people who have no income should not be borrowing large sums of money to buy houses. People who are much smarter than them should not be betting on those mortgages at Goldman Sachs and elsewhere. But people got caught up in this mania.
But one guy Michael Lewis writes about, he wasn't a young guy. Maybe he was that more sober, older, lower testosterone guy.
Well, I think the other element to this is that, yes, Wall Street is about making money. That is what capitalism is about, and that is what it should be about. That is why the whole other side of this, which is regulation, corporate culture, transparency, all of those things are really, really important, because if you just unleash a group of people and tell them, do whatever you have to do to make money, where is that going to lead? It's going to cause serious problems.
Let me ask you a reality check question, because I know we've got to let you go in a second. But the guys on Wall Street are wrapped around a whole lot of money, and they know it. And, you know, lots of them are former athletes. And, I mean, these are competitors. They're not going to let go of this. How on earth would you unlock the testosterone hold on the levers of Wall Street? How would that happen, Sheila?
I think it's going to be a slow process. It's going to require a bit of a fight. I think regulation is one part of it. You can't regulate gender diversity, obviously, or endocrine diversity. But I think you can regulate risk-taking. That has been that's something that was a clear problem. Regulations had been weakened over a number of years, and that's really a major, major contributor to the crisis. But there is also a reason to be hopeful. Wall Street culture has evolved. There was a time when the newspapers were filled with articles about discrimination, lawsuits, and
it was about 2 seconds ago. Everybody was lunching at strip clubs and having hookers in the heart of it.
Right, that's it. And there have been books and movies made about this. So I think that has improved. I think there are some people who would say it can still be a bit of a sexist place. But no, I think that big banks have made huge strides in addressing some of those problems. And I believe that many of them do want more women. I think it's a complicated issue of finding the women, keeping them there, making it hospitable to them, finding mentors, and so on. It's a complicated issue.
Sheila Kohatkar, you've got us thinking with your big piece in New York Magazine, What If Women Ran Wall Street? Thanks for joining us today, Sheila.
My pleasure. It was fun.
Let's get a call from Leah in Westchester, Pennsylvania. Leah, you're on the air.
Yeah. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Thanks. It's an interesting conversation, and I do certainly believe in the impact of testosterone and how it might affect male behavior. But I'm a young woman, and I have a lot of young women friends, and I've noticed that women can also be extremely competitive. So I feel like the competitive nature of women can't be discounted, as I think it has been a little bit in this conversation. So I think another interesting point to consider is sort of society and the rewards that men and women have for doing certain things. And I think things are changing, but at this point, still, men are rewarded for having powerful positions, for earning a lot of money, for the kind of, you know, jobs and behavior that people on Wall Street do and have and display. And women aren't necessarily rewarded in the same way. So I think that while, you know, the biological certainly has an impact, I think that the sociological can't be discounted and must have a really interesting impact on this as well.
Leah, you're great, and we will pick it up. I thank you very much for your call. Nancy Kane, what about it? You're at Harvard Business School. You must see very competitive women all the time. So let's refine this a little bit. I mean, it's not, we're not saying women aren't competitive. They don't care about winning. You must see hyper-competitive women in your world.
Women care about winning. Most of the successful entrepreneurs of this generation and the next two generations in this country will be women. Women have started many more businesses than men, and that's hugely about putting a stake in the ground and trying to accomplish something. Women are competitive and women are driven. I see many of them. They're mm-hmm. part and parcel of my world. So I don't think this is about a drive to succeed at all. And I don't think that what we're really talking about is some kind of massive difference in the overall objectives of women fund managers or women traders versus male fund managers and male traders. We are talking about something that shakes out, right, in terms of performance that we need to be conscious of, which is that women, when women are involved in fund management and in companies, profits and performance over a sustainable period of time are higher. So we need to think about that if what we're interested in is success.
Let's go to Jay in Newton, Massachusetts. Jay, you're on the air.
Hi. I'd just like to say that I think you've raised some great points. My neighbor here is a stockbroker, and I really love like being around him and his friends because this whole macho ethic kind of survives there. They're heavily into sports, you know, the Pats, the Patriots yeah. weekend. Those are big things for him. But it's a good deal because my daughter babysits there, and at $10 an hour, I'm getting some of the money. And since I'm unemployed, it's pretty funny to hear those guys talk about the monies they're going to make, and I'm sitting there going, wow, must be a nice world.
What if their machismo is part of what, you know, blew your job away, Jay?
It did. That's what I always kind of laugh when we're having a beer out in the garage.
You're very good-natured about it, my friend.
Well, you know, you can't be down on it because – like I say, he employs my daughter, and he does keep the economy going a little bit. But I'm one of those high-tech victims of the whole stock market fallout. Well, but thanks for letting me share the point.
I appreciate it. What goes around comes around. Maybe the neighbor's machismo ends up in your lost job. May you get a new one real quick. Jim in Newport, Rhode Island. Jim, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Yeah.
If the women are the more sensible ones, how come there aren't wives or girlfriends of these stockbrokers who are saying, honey, we don't need the new car. Honey, we don't need to go to the Michelin star restaurant. Let's go for Chinese food tonight. So if they're the sensible ones, how come they're not driving their husbands at home? I think they could be blamed also.
So you're blaming the women because they want the big house in the Hamptons.
Exactly. They may want the new car or the new coach bag. Well, the latest coach bag, honey. So he's going to go to work and he's going to make a little bit more money to get the new coach bag or the Jimmy Choo's.
Well, but come on. I mean, okay, but that's a different role, is it? I mean, they're at home. They're not the ones on the floor. I don't know. Nancy, what do you hear in that?
Well, it's true that women are the major decision maker household by household on 78% of financial decisions and about 74% of consumption decisions. So to that extent, I guess we could kind of look at the reverb here and blame all the wives of all the traders. But I don't know. I think
I kind of think the guys
indirect.
Would go for it even without that. But that's yeah. I mean, it's a complicated world. Wow. I'm not sure where this ends up. John Coates, with your, I mean, you're in London. Do they want to hear about this there? They've got a macho trading culture as well, or do they just want to get the guys back in the business and pump up another bubble and make a lot of money?
You mean the government?
No, I mean, you know, the what do you call it, London? The trading part of town?
The city.
The city.
The city, yeah. Well, of course, everyone in the city wants things to go back to normal or the way it used to be. They've got a vested interest in a type of compensation scheme that rewards high variance of P&L, which stands, profit and loss.
Mm-hmm.
There's not a lot of appetite for change in the city.
Which is their equivalent of all our Wall Street. We've got something really interesting on the table here. It may go to the heart of trading. It may go to the heart of booms and busts. It may go to the heart of capitalism. We'll come back and talk about that. John Coates with us from the University of Cambridge today. Please stand by in London. And Nancy Kane of the Harvard Business School with us in the studio. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Talking this hour about men, women, and Wall Street, testosterone in the boom and bust, and whether there's a better way, a better endocrine diversity that might get us a better outcome. Nancy Kane is with us from the Harvard Business School. John Coates is here, former derivatives trader for Deutsche Bank in New York. He's now doing research in neuroscience and finance at the University of Cambridge. He joins us today from London. And that's, it occurs to me that it's not just about Wall Street. It's about kind of just, you know, down and dirty capitalism way back. I don't know, pirates and people out grabbing stuff and accumulating things. It seems like a guy thing, or was, or is that just a misinterpretation of what capitalism's built on? Is testosterone right down there in the core fuel tank?
Sure it is. You know, Keynes wrote about animal spirits, and
those come in more varieties than male, though.
Yeah, exactly. But I think the energy, right, call it life force, the life force of capitalism has a lot to do with this drive to succeed and a drive to win. David Brooks wrote a fascinating column yesterday saying, our problem is we have no spirit anymore. We have no energy. So energy.
Well, I just don't agree with that. Let's go.
I'm with you, Tom. But the point is that energy and the vitality and the drive to win, of which testosterone is a small component, is at the heart of capitalism. So I think that leads us to an interesting question, which is, when does too much energy, right, or unbridled, right, life force become something that may be dangerous to the global structure and the global stability of capitalism?
Now, women have plenty of life force, too, though. If it were a 50-50 economy, not just in Wall Street but all over, would we have a different kind of capitalism, or is that a scared male way of looking at it?
Boy, that's a really good question, but let me give you two interesting kind of takes at that. First, Norway has just mandated that all companies in Norway must have boards that are made up of at least 40% women.
Okay.
And Iceland has just said that women need to play a major role in recovering banks. In fact, they've put the Norwegian government, I mean the Icelandic government, has put women in charge of two of their major banks.
Because the guys really nearly destroyed that country.
Well, exactly. And so they're not doing this because it feels good, and they're not doing it to be politically correct, and they're not doing it because of diversity regulation. They're doing it because they want to keep the system functioning.
But do women want to do this? What percentage of your graduates at Harvard Business School go into finance?
Smaller and smaller. I mean, we've gone from 40% of our graduating class going into finance in 2008, for example, to about 10%. And when I say finance, I'm including all the markets.
And what portion of that 10% then is women? Oh, do women want to do this?
I don't know if we've broken out the numbers exactly like that, but I'm going to take a rough ballpark guess and guess somewhere less than a quarter of those numbers. And I think women have very mixed feelings. Think about it for a second. We've got a cultural issue. Mm-hmm. We've got a life kind of lifestyle issue, right? We're 90-hour work weeks,
glued to your
trading
Bloomberg
floor,
screen,
absolutely,
your hair out.
Right? You got a mentoring issue, which is that a lot of top women from finance are in very, very short supply, and some of the most prominent ones, people like Sally Krawcheck and Zoe Cruz and other people, you know, aren't so prominent anymore. So all those issues are very important. I think there's one other interesting issue that comes out of the bubble, and that for women, and that is that, you know, after the bubble happened, and then after September 11th, and we were going to have a new world, a better world, right? There was a lot of talk about women's role on Wall Street. And ironically, as Joanne Lippman from The Times said a few months ago, ironically, what happened is that the culture, the testosterone-driven or life force culture of those banks did not change. It actually, all of our culture became harsher, louder, more individualistic, more narcissistic. And none of those things are going to help women along as much as they help men along.
John Coates, you've done the research here, but look around. Do women want to get into this roller derby? I know they're in the real roller derby, but do they want to get into finance?
That's a really good question. I've got a lot of my friends that are still back on Wall Street or on Bay Street in Toronto or in the city here in London. When I've been doing this research, I've been talking to all of them, and I asked them what percentage of your trading floor is women. And well, where we've been doing our studies is but 250 traders, three or four of which are women. And that's about right. I don't think you get much more than 5% women on the trading floor. But the thing is, most of these banks want more women traders. And the friends of mine now who are either running departments or trading floors or whatever say that whenever they hire a woman, they say, do you want to go into trading? And they almost invariably say, no, we want to go into sales or research or origination or structured products or something else, but they don't want to go into trading.
Why do they want more women? Do they really want a different culture? Do they really want trading to be changed, you know, down at the endocrine level?
They probably want speaking cynically, I think they probably just want more women traders so they brag about
Right. Looks good in the annual report.
Diver- Yeah, diversity advances within the firm. But the thing is, so why don't they want to be – why don't women want to be on these trading floors? A lot of the research says, well, they're more risk-averse than men. They're less competitive. And that caller that you had a couple phone calls ago, I think she was dead right, that that's not the issue. Women are extreme. It can be just as competitive as men. And they are not – I'm not convinced that they're – that it's an issue of risk. The reason for that is the following. If you go from the type of trading that you see on most trading floors on Wall Street, it's very, very fast-paced, in and out, high-frequency trading, and you get very, very few women there. However, when you get into asset management firms over here in the city, for example, you very quickly find firms that have got 50 to 60% women. So if it were a question of risk alone, you wouldn't be finding that many women in asset management because it's a form of risk-taking.
Yes, of course.
It's just a different form of risk-taking.
It's just right, not right on the floor, not right on the firing line.
Yeah, well,
it's on the firing line, but not where they, exactly where the trades are made. That's all I mean to say.
Yeah, I don't. We haven't been able to pinpoint exactly what the difference is, but my hunch is the following: that it's not a difference in appetite for risk because the women in asset management firms
are taking risk, very big risk.
Mm-hmm. But we think the difference may be simply a question of timing. That the guys on the trading floors that you see on the TVs and in the movies screaming and yelling, they're given, you know, 2 seconds to make a decision, 30 seconds. Whereas when you're in asset management, you can take the time to do your research, make your decision, put on the trade, and sit with it for weeks, months, or years if you want to. Whereas you don't have that luxury, or it's not luxury, it's just not, it's a different style of trading on the trading floors where you have to be, where you're not given the time to give a more complete analysis. So it's entirely possible that the difference between men and women in finance isn't to do with risk or competitiveness. It might just be different, a different style of analyzing information.
But Nancy, aren't the asset management firms in a way more important ultimately? Because it's, I mean, the guys on the floor, they're doing the trades they're asked to do, right? I mean, I'm a little, if the asset management firms are cool, calm, and collected and have a lot of women represented, why wouldn't that already be a kind of balance wheel or governor on the out-of-control testosterone vision of what happened?
Because what happens in asset management firms over a stretch of time doesn't necessarily affect how we play our cards at the casino. And the daily game, right, the daily results of which cards are turned up, the Dow in our case, the Nike in Tokyo, choose your exchange, right, has this very powerful, not just financial effect, macroeconomic effect, organizational effect, psychological effect back to animal spirits. So those cowboys or those poker players are a big, big deal. Playing their video games fast and eager and collecting points. I've been studying financial entrepreneurs for a long, long time across the centuries, and the points, the winning piece is much more important at the top levels than the money per se. We're collecting points.
So I won.
I won at the video game today. And as Sheila pointed out, as John's pointed out, This is a very important commons problem because it has huge effects way outside that trading floor and way outside those boys playing video games.
We live in their universe even if we're not in that room, in the boiler room.
You bet. The man who lost his job lives in that universe. That had something to do, believe me, with what happened to the Dow.
Merle in Buffalo, New York. Merle, you're on the air.
Yes. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Before moving to Buffalo, I lived in Chicago and worked at the Chicago Mercantile Exchange.
Oh, then you know what we're talking about.
Yeah, I remember these guys, you know, every day. I mean, I didn't work on the floor. I worked in IT, but I remember these guys in the lobby, and they're pretty aggressive and pretty loud and wear loud coats and elevator shoes and everything just to be able to trade. But they're really just the photo op anymore. Pretty much most of the trading is electronic. So these traders that you see on the floor are really just, like I said, the surface. That most of them are either sitting at home in their pajamas or sitting at a desk in an office, or actually the bulk of the trading is computer-driven. It's algorithm-driven.
Right,
so I don't know what role testosterone plays in that off the floor.
Let us pick that up, Merlin. I appreciate your calling. What's photo op and what's spread out and what does it matter? Let me get one more here first. Jerry in Farmington, Connecticut. Jerry, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Just one comment or a question. Regardless of the testosterone levels and regardless of the machismo, one of the problems that I see is that people who are making these trades, who are sometimes being cowboys on the market, they make, you know, seven-figure bonuses at the end of the year. But if they then do an abject job, they don't suffer individual penalties. They still get their bonuses the following year, as we've seen where banks have had huge losses, mm-hmm. and individuals still walk away with bonuses. I think if there are very few occupations where we can go through life where we get rewarded for doing well and still get rewarded for doing poorly. And I think if there was some individual repercussions, I think that might curb their enthusiasm, as it were.
Yeah, we hear it, Jerry, and thanks for that. John Coates, a couple things on the table there. One, you know, not everybody's on the trading floor. A lot of people are spread out at a whole lot of computer desks. Does it matter on the testosterone front if everybody's clustered in one hot room, or can they be just in one hot bubble spread all over a country?
I think you get the winner effect kicks in when you're making above average profits. So I don't think it really matters where you're sitting. He raises a really good point about the size of the black boxes, as they're called, these computerized trading programs. Mm-hmm. At the end of the day, they're not really the people making decisions on the allocation of capital around the world. Most of them are high-frequency trading or statistical arbitrage. And even amongst those, most of them are execution only. So there's still someone making a decision. They're just using the computer to execute the trade because the computers do it more efficiently than human. But the decision's still left to the human. Your last caller raised a great point.
On compensation.
That I would say, I listed before other factors besides hormones that contribute to the credit crunch, and I'd say the compensation schemes are probably number one, because you can have a situation. Imagine two traders. We'll call the first one tortoise. No, hare.
Okay.
Tortoise and the hare. The hare makes $100 million a year for 4 years, gets a 20% payout. That's $20 million
mm-hmm.
a year.
Yeah.
But on the fifth year, loses $500 million and doesn't get a bonus. So after five years, he's for 5 years, he's lost the bank $100 million, but he's pocketed $80 million. The other trader, let's call him Tortoise, makes $10 million a year mm-hmm. for 5 years and gets a smaller payout, say 10%. So at the end of the year, end of 5 years, he's made the bank $100 million. And he's pocketed, what's that? I've lost track of my math.
$5 million. Right. But that tells the whole story in a way.
Yeah. So which of those traders do you want to be?
We'll have to think about that. There are moral issues come into play. Nancy, here's a web comment from Julia. She says, a good female friend of mine was a stockbroker for one of the biggest traders. She was the most ferocious and smart competitor I've ever known, did very well for her customers. However, she ended up feeling forced to leave for two reasons. One, she saw all of the good accounts routinely given to males, regardless of performance or seniority. And two, she was under constant pressure to sell products that she thought were bad ideas.
Okay, second point first. Women tend to play, at least over the last 8 or 9 years, a bigger role as whistleblowers for whatever reason.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
There's a woman saying, no, I'm not going to do mm-hmm. it, right? And women seem to be in that kind of position more frequently and want to act on their consciousness, even at the risk of their job, more frequently
mm-hmm.
than men.
Mm-hmm.
Secondly, to take the first point second, girlfriend, that is unfortunately still how it is in large, powerful institutions. Ideas, products, deals, board meeting, energy, it goes to men before it goes to women. And to change that, company by company, is a major deal. And it has just begun. And in some places, it'll be glacial. It'll be at a glacial pace.
So what's going to happen here? I mean, John's doing the research. We see how this sort of testosterone cascade can push people deeper and deeper into the bubble and feeling just fine about it. You described how what happens in that little boiler room affects, the whole economy. Do we just have to wait for women to gradually evolve into, more positions, more presence here?
So look, we got a ticking time bomb. One of my students who was a nuclear examiner at power plants in Eastern Europe said after he looked at the financial crisis, give me one of those plants in Eastern Europe with problem rods any day over the financial system the way it is now. We have to make a collective decision about whether we're going to tolerate lower peaks and more shallow valleys in the interest of keeping the damn thing running.
Who's going to advocate that? I mean,
you would like to see some of our elective officials and some of the gentlemen and women, but primarily gentlemen that serve as fiduciaries on public companies standing up to say something
exactly.
about long-run interest of the system
and
the stakeholders.
Who's going to stand up and say affirmative action, all over Wall Street? Maybe they will, but that doesn't sound necessarily like a winner. What about the fiduciary side? Is there a sense, sort of blowing in the wind that they could say we've got to have more women and a different kind of trading and a different mentality, or are those still losers?
I think we will see a few smart, stalwart men and women of character at the top of these institutions stand up for what makes sense, not just for them and their pocketbooks, but for all the different people around the world that are affected. But they will not be the majority. So it will require, as capitalism has always required, some guardrails and some tempering of that energy and of those out-of-whack compensation systems. And it remains to be seen, after the shenanigans of healthcare, whether we have the elected officials in the White House and in Congress that can do something of such import.
Well, we'll follow the regulations, but on the cultural side, do you see the street stepping away from the cowboys, John, or is that just,
I think it'd be very difficult.
I think it's a real failure of corporate governance. I don't know why the boards have ever let this stuff go through, because it is not in a bank's interest. It's not in a shareholder's interest to have a bank blowing up every 5 years. So I think if boards were demand a change in compensation schemes so that people were paid maybe every 5 years instead of every year, we'd probably see a very different kind of risk-taking taking place on Wall Street.
Well, you've given us a really interesting, different angle on what we've just come through and maybe where we're headed. John Coates at the University of Cambridge joining us from London. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks, Tom.
And Nancy Kane, professor of business administration at the Harvard Business School, author of The Story of American Business. Nancy, it's always great to see you. Thanks for coming in.
Always a pleasure to be here, Tom.
Listeners, thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.